Thanks for tuning into this podcast episode. I am really excited for this episode to be shared amongst parents because I think it's really valuable information. It can help put your mind at ease about when to make a phone call to the doctor or to the nurse or to make that trip to the ED. If you stay all the way to the end of the podcast, I share with you something that I've been working on for quite a few years that's finally come to fruition and share a little code with you. So let's dive in and talk about when to call the doctor. Space for conversation around women's health through the lens of naturopathic and Eastern medicine. I am Sandy Ross, and this is Her Earth Medicine Podcast. This podcast is multi-leveled, episodes for patient education to graduate practitioner level. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you gain value from this episode. Welcome to the Her Earth Medicine Podcast, pediatric nurse Nicole.
Hi, Sandy. Thanks for having me on your podcast today.
Thank you for joining us. I think this is going to be a great episode for parents to tune into. So before we get chatting about the questions I'm going to fire at you all regarding children and pediatric health, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do for work?
Yeah, sure. So my name's Nicole and I am a registered nurse. So I have a Bachelor of Nursing, a Bachelor of Applied Science, and I also have a postgraduate degree in pediatrics. I've been a nurse for almost a decade and I currently work at a really busy pediatric emergency department, and I also work on one of the wards within the hospital as well, one of the medical wards, and I have experience working in education and a variety of other wards too. And I also deliver and facilitate first aid courses and a lot of infant and child first aid courses throughout Victoria.
And that's through Rhythm First Aid, isn't it? Sorry, I forgot to introduce that. You're the founder of Rhythm First Aid also.
Oh, thank you. Yes, Rhythm First Aid is the name of my first aid business, yes.
Yeah.
And so we also have, in addition to first aid courses, we also have a number of products as well. So any sort of child or baby health-related workplace first aid kits, defibrillators, we assist workplaces and families and individuals with those needs too.
Okay, great. Yeah, so and that's why I wanted to bring you on, because I've seen your content, I know how good you are at educating, and I feel like this information can be so valuable for a mother that's very anxious and concerned when their child gets sick. So what I wanted to discuss today was basically like when to call the doctor or the nurse or when to seek medical attention. Mm. So you might have been trying your natural toolkit with homeopathic medicines, herbal medicine, Shonishin, whatever it is naturally you're trying, and there's at some point we need to go, okay, when do we need to seek medical attention? So that's exactly why I brought you on today, so you can get that real clear information out there for us.
Yeah, and it's such a relevant topic at the moment. You know, all we're hearing in the media is hospital systems and all healthcare systems overrun. And this winter has been a shocking winter in terms of the amount of illnesses going around. So it's all really relevant. And as you said, the more information, education that parents have and that they're able to equip themselves with this knowledge, it's, you know, also helps their mental load and helps them to troubleshoot and work through illnesses to know when to seek help and what help is appropriate for them.
Totally, because there's nothing worse than when your child is sick and then you're just scattered and anxious and not sure what to do. So getting equipped with the right information prior to your child being sick, I think, can be really, really valuable. So in saying that, I would love to hear everything you've got to say about fevers, because I feel like this is a great starting point. Fevers in children can be very scary. There's a lot of concerns. People get worried about things like seizures. So I want to debunk it all. I want to hear all your thoughts. You know, do we take temperatures? Do we not take temperatures? What do we use as medication if we're going to apply medication? When to use it? What we can try naturally first? All things fevers.
Okay, so I think this episode will turn into an 8-hour episode.
Okay.
Because there's so much information to chat about fever, and I think that fever is probably the number one topic that has the most amount of misconceptions and myths surrounding it.
Mm-hmm.
Fever causes such a huge level of stress and worry for parents. And the important thing to remember about fever is that fever is really helpful and that fever is not harmful. So when a child or a baby or an adult has a fever, so a fever is a body temperature over 38 degrees Celsius, and so that's for all ages. So once a baby or a child or an adult spikes a fever over 38 degrees, it's like the body's immune system firing up to say, hey, there's a bug or a germ somewhere in the body. The body's heating up to try and fight it off. So we know that babies and children get sick a lot, and this is also very normal for them as well to get sick quite a lot. So when they are sick, a lot of the times they will have these fevers. So the average preschool age child has between 6 to 12 viral illnesses per year. So your child will get a fever at some stage if they haven't already had some, and so it's important to remember that a fever is not harmful. It's helpful with the immune system fighting off the infection. It's also important to know that the number on the thermometer is not indicative of severity of illness. So if the number on the thermometer is 40.2 degrees, it doesn't necessarily mean that the child is any more unwell than a child who has a temperature of 38.2 degrees. The reading on the thermometer is just one part of your assessment. And once that number is over 38 degrees, it doesn't matter how high it is. It doesn't tell us how unwell the child is. You need to be looking at for other things such as their breathing, their hydration, and their behaviour.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a couple of, points to that. If any baby under the age of 12 weeks has a fever over 38 degrees, you need to take them to the emergency department. And that is just a blanket rule for any baby under the age of 12 weeks, temperature over 38, emergency. Nearest emergency department. It may not be an emergency. A lot may not need to be done. There might be some investigations, but because they're such a vulnerable age, we can't take any risks with them. They're far too little and far too precious.
Mm-hmm.
In saying that as well, there are other populations, say if someone was immunocompromised, where fever might be really dangerous or really relevant to them. So if you have any information, receiving information that's specific to your child, you'd obviously be following that specific information for your child. And everything that we're talking about today, when we're talking about fever, this is just generalized information and education. So a lot of the time when the body gets a fever, it's a virus, but other things that it could be a bacteria, or it could be some sort of, you know, unusual fungal infection as well. So really remember, it's important to remember, it's a normal immune response. So when your child has the fever, if they are uncomfortable, if they're in pain, then absolutely give them some pain relief, because our aim here is for the child to be to ease and alleviate their discomfort and their pain, and for them to be as happy as possible. So if a child has a high fever and they're happy, playing, you know, they're drinking really well, their behavior's okay, then you can just leave them. The fever can, run its course. On the flip side, if a child was really miserable and upset and in pain, then definitely offer them pain relief. We don't want the child to be in pain or discomfort. There's an old wives' tale. What used to happen back in the day, or maybe not back in the day, even sort of 20 years ago, is that as soon as a child would get a fever, parents would administer paracetamol, ibuprofen to bring the fever down, because there was a thought that the fever was really dangerous or that it would cause a seizure.
Mm.
However, we now know that that is not the case, and that's not what causes a febrile convulsion, and which I can touch on in a moment, what causes a febrile convulsion. And it's important that every time your child gets a fever, you don't continually bring down the fever, because there is evidence to show that that can lengthen the duration of illness as well, which is quite interesting. In regards to choosing what pain relief you administer your child if they are in pain, the most two common and the two that are available in Australia are paracetamol, which is commonly known as Panadol, Dimadon, or Panamax, and that can be given to a baby over the age of 1 month. And the second one is ibuprofen. So ibuprofen is commonly known as Nurofen, Advil, or Phenapide, and that can be given to a baby over the age of 3 months. It is safe to give a full dose of paracetamol and ibuprofen together, or you can alternate them. paracetamol is processed by the liver and or excreted by the liver, and ibuprofen is excreted by the kidneys. So that may help you decide which medication that you were to administer. Keeping in mind that ibuprofen is an anti-inflammatory, so often that works better for inflammatory type pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
Before we go into chatting about febrile convulsions, Sandy, was there anything else for fever
that you'd like
to unpick?
What can we do to aid the child naturally before using medication? So what do you recommend? So there's the warm cloth on the neck, you know, taking their clothes off, giving them cold water to sip on. Like, what are some of those things that you recommend that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So you just want your child to be comfortable. And mm-hmm. as you mentioned, all of those things, you know, like a face washer or taking off a layer of clothing, getting your child to relax, that is all just assisting their comfort levels. You don't need, if your child has a fever, definitely do not put them in a cold bath or a cold shower.
Yeah.
You don't need to strip off all their clothing. We just want them to be as comfortable as possible. So absolutely what you've mentioned, if they're really hot and bothered, you could give them a little icy pop, you know, something cold, or cool sips of water or Hydralyte or whatever you were, fluids that you were giving to them to help them with their illness and their hydration. But again, if the child is happy, you don't need to bring down their fever.
Okay, that's great information.
So just remember that. Yeah,
no, that's golden information. And the other thing I wanted to just double check on, so are you a fan of taking temperatures or not taking temperatures?
Great question. And it depends on the age group. So when we're talking about fevers, if your baby's under the age of 3 months, all this information is irrelevant. If a three-month-old, under three-month-old has a temperature over 38 degrees, you need to take them to hospital. So if your baby was under the age of 3 months old and you felt like they were a little bit unsettled, or they may feel a little bit more warm than usual, or they're a little bit more sleepy than usual, anything that just made you think maybe it doesn't seem quite right, then definitely I would recommend taking their temperature with an axilla, so an under the arm thermometer. If your child is over the age of 3 months, say for example you've got a two-year-old with gastro and it's obvious that they've got vomiting and they've got diarrhea, by you taking their temperature is not really going to change your management, because you know that they're probably going to have a fever because they've got gastroenteritis. So you've got to sort of understand why you're taking their temperature and will that change your management. If a child's got a cold, we know they're going to get a fever, and it doesn't matter if the temperature's 38.2, 39.2, 40.2, 41.2, because you're not focusing on that number on the thermometer, you're focusing on the way they look. And I find in my experience that parents that are continually taking children's temperatures, it provides them with more worry and more anxiety, because they become fixated on the number on the thermometer, and then they think, oh no, the temperature's gone up to 40 degrees, the child's even more unwell, and it gives them more panic rather than taking a step back and looking at the overall child, you know, what's their behaviour like, what's their hydration like, what's their neurological state like.
Yeah.
So I would, you know, people can absolutely use the thermometer and take a child's temperature if they like, but just remembering that it's only, illness is like a big puzzle, and the temperature and that reading on the thermometer is just one piece of the puzzle. So ensure you're looking at the bigger picture as well.
Okay, no, that's great information. And what else did you want to add for the febrile convulsions?
Yes. So it's a really common misconception that people think that if a baby or a child's temperature goes too high, that will cause them to have a seizure or a convulsion. And so that is a myth. The thing that causes febrile convulsions is a rapid change in body temperature. So it's not the high temperature that causes it. If a child has a really high body temperature, if they're going to have a febrile convulsion, they would have had one when the temperature was on its way up. So there's nothing that you can do to prevent your child from having a febrile convulsion. They're relatively common, with 1 in 30 children having a febrile convulsion, and unfortunately if it's just going to happen, it's going to happen. There's nothing, by giving paracetamol and ibuprofen, it's not going to stop it or control it. It's just one of those things it's really important that you're aware of and you know what to do when a child's having a febrile convulsion, that you've completed some level of medical first aid. But yes, just remembering it's a rapid change in body temperature that causes a seizure.
Okay. Thanks for touching on that. Now, I would love to hear all about coughs because, I mean, I personally experienced my daughter having croup and how scary that was when I was watching her chest and she had the stridor and I could hear that bark so clearly coming through. And, you know, I knew the onset was usually okay the first night and second night is when it usually gets bad. We had the ambulance come. They were amazing straight away with the adrenaline, up all night in the hospital on steroids. But, you know, like, we did the right thing by calling the ambulance, and that's something that's really important to understand when a cough can become dangerous, that it's impacting a child's breathing. So can we touch on coughs? Maybe we can start with croup and then we can move on to other coughs after that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so scary. And the thing with croup is that it often is, it's always worse at night.
Yes.
And it's often really sudden onset. I'm not sure if it was the same with your little one, but they might go from being okay, they're asleep and they wake up with this strata type noise and this really barking, still like cough. And it is really scary. And if you've got a child with croup in the middle of the night, you should have a really low threshold to call an ambulance because it is inflammation of the upper airway and it can get become dangerous really quickly as well. And so, as you mentioned with croup, it's that really barking cough, as I just demonstrated, and that strata. And so croup is relatively common in children, and croup is inflammation of the upper airway. So a child, it's the way that their airways respond to a virus that they may have. And so a crouping cough is that really barking cough. So if you would hear that barking or seal-like cough, it's often an indication that your child has croup. And the generalised advice for croup is if your child has a strata at rest, so if they're sitting, relaxing at rest, like their breathing is noisy, then that would be the indication to call an ambulance. So some kids that have a cough, you may hear people say, oh, it sounds a bit croupy. And so that's what that is. Most of the coughs that children have is a cough associated with a cold or a virus. And often when a child's unwell with a cold, the cough's the last thing to get better. And there's also something called a post-viral cough as well, where a cough can linger.
So many of these around at the moment.
Yeah. And it's really frustrating and it's really hard, particularly, you know, in little ones, because sometimes they can also become quite distressed by their cough as well. Yeah. And I guess with coughs, it's really hard because there's so many different things that cause coughs, and you don't want to always suppress a cough either, because if a child's acutely unwell with a respiratory illness, often they'll have a moist productive cough, and that's actually a good thing that they're coughing and moving all that mucus around. And sometimes some kids will cough so much that they'll have a vomit, and it'll be a mucusy vomit, and whilst it's as horrible it is that they vomit, it's actually not the worst thing because they've actually expelled all this mucus out of their body.
And they usually won't cough after that.
Exactly. And it's often, like it's, you can see, you know, mucus, it's all like the phlegmy sort of stream within the vomit. And so, yeah, often the cough is helpful, as horrific as it is. Sometimes kids might be coughing. It could be a sign that they have asthma. So not always, so it's definitely worth checking in with a GP or your healthcare professional. Some kids that have a dry, irritating cough, particularly at night, it may be a sign of asthma. And other things, the majority of the time a cough is caused by a virus or it's a post-viral cough. As mentioned, occasionally it can be a bacterial element that's causing the cough. But we at the hospital, we don't recommend cough medicines for children under the age of 6. And what we would recommend that can sometimes help with a bit of coughing is honey. But remembering that you can't give honey to a baby under the age of 12 months. So if a baby has a cough, there's not really much that you can do to stop the cough. And as mentioned, depending on the type of cough, you probably don't want to suppress it anyway. But yeah, just little measures to try and make them as comfortable as possible.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll just touch on back to my daughter with the croup while I remember to tell this story, because I feel like it's a very, because I'm a clinician, I do Chinese medicine and naturopathic medicine, so I hear this all the time. So with the onset of my daughter's croup, it was Easter and we had been out doing Easter hunts and, you know, in the cold wind, and she was eating so much more chocolate and dairy than she normally would and sugar. And really, I hadn't given her too much sugar at that point. She was only 2 years old. And it was once she had, like, I think it was 3 rounds of those Easter egg hunts and whatnot, cold wind, that night, boom, had croup straight away. And I hear that story a lot is when kids have been out in the cold wind, a draft, they've maybe been eating a little bit extra sugar, dairy, whatnot. That is such a big cause of croup onset. So just keep that in mind if you're listening, that if your child is prone to croup, the weather can really impact them. That cold draft wind when you're out, and that's why we're seeing a lot around in winter at the moment, because it's been really chilly. Everyone's out and about in the afternoons. Boom, that night, their child goes home, they wake up with a barking cough. So I feel like just that prevention for croup can be really good information.
Yeah, and so croup is really common, and it's the way that the body or the person's airways responding to that virus. So the way that I'll explain it is, say you've got a three-year-old kinder class and all kids have the exact same virus, exact same cold, just one of those kids might get croup. And so they have an underlying virus. It's a way that their body has responded to croup. So some kids are more likely to get croup and are more prone to it, and some kids, once they've had croup once, unfortunately, they can get it again. I'm not sure if your daughter has had it again, but it's, you know, something to have at the back of your mind if she did become unwell with the respiratory illness, that it may happen again. And then, of course, there are some environmental impacts that can sometimes lead to respiratory illnesses. For example, particularly with asthma, sometimes the pollen or changes in weather can trigger asthma attacks as well.
And I think, is that because children, I remember back in my pathophysiology days when I was teaching at Endeavours, probably like 4 or 5 years ago now, that children have a 3 millimetre airway versus adults is 10, is that correct? So I think what we're seeing is that real inflamed airway, and that's why they can't, that they get that, because if that becomes flamed, there's not much room for movement in there.
Yeah, so your airway, so your trachea, which is your windpipe at the top, is roughly the diameter of your pinky finger. So 1 millimetre of swelling within a small child's airway causes 16 times resistance, which is why you get that noise, in comparison to a 1 millimetre of swelling in an adult's airway. It's only 4 times the resistance. So that little bit of swelling does cause, that strata and that barking cough, because the airway is small and narrow to start with in comparison to an adult's trachea or airway.
And I feel like just understanding that, you go, okay, that's why we've got to take the child's cough a little bit more seriously, especially when they have strider.
That barking cough, yeah. And it, without, you know, freaking you all out, croup can get dangerous really quickly. So as you did, Sandy, and as you said, it's often a sudden onset, and you need to have that low threshold to call an ambulance. And because the medication, that's the paramedics, they can give it to you in your home, like you said, sounds like your daughter had a nebulizer. They can give that on the way to hospital if needed, if the child deteriorated as well. If you did decide to drive your child to an emergency department with any sort of respiratory conditions, it's really important that there's always two adults. So one adult driving the car and then one adult in the back with your child or the child to be keeping an eye on their breathing, because you can't safely drive to hospital and keep an eye on their breathing. It's just far too dangerous, and it's not worth the risk. So depending on where you live, you could be an hour from your nearest emergency department, or multiple hours, depending if you live really remote, or you could be 10 minutes away. So yourself and the other care providers for that child would make that decision. But making sure you've always got two adults if you're driving to an emergency department.
Yeah, okay, great.
With a breathing problem.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Great point. Can we maybe touch on gastroenteritis, the lovely stomach bug people know it as?
Yes, yes. Gastroenteritis is lovely, isn't it? I feel like every time you get gastro, you think, oh, I'm never taking my health for granted again.
Yeah.
It just makes you
feel like, if someone in the house gets gastro, you're just like, oh no, we're all going to get it. It's hygiene.
Oh, it's so challenging, isn't it? So gastroenteritis. So gastroenteritis is inflammation of the gut, inflammation of the bowel lining. So often gastroenteritis is caused by virus. But sometimes gastro could be caused by bacteria. So a child could get food poisoning or salmonella or something like that, which is bacterial. So that would need antibiotics, but most of the time it's virus. So it doesn't require antibiotics. So gastro often starts off with the vomiting and then will progress to some diarrhea as well. The child will be struggling to keep down fluids. They'll often have a fever associated with that as well. Because they're losing so much fluid at both ends, it's important that you try your best to maintain their hydration. So hydration is absolutely the priority here. Again, we don't really want to be tracking, don't need to be tracking the fevers and worrying exactly what the temperature is doing. Hydration, hydration, hydration. So your child is not going to want to feel like eating food, and that's okay. You can offer them fluidy type foods, but any type of fluids is absolutely the priority. You want to make sure that they're hydrated and be trying to keep on top of their hydration, because this is when the children become unwell, and this is when we see them in the emergency department where they haven't been able to stay on top of it. Sometimes you won't be able to. You need to present to an emergency department, because your child literally will not stop vomiting, and they may not have passed urine in a day or something, and they're really dehydrated. You need to see a GP, or you need to see you need to rock up to emergency because they're so dehydrated. They need some help to break that nausea cycle to maintain their hydration or to be rehydrated.
What's some tips for hydration? So, like, if they're obviously vomiting and having diarrhea, the big sips are not going to stay down. Do you recommend just small sips are enough to keep someone hydrated? Icy poles, like the electrolyte rehydration stuff. What's some? How much are we talking about keeping them hydrated before having to seek the emergency department?
Yes, exactly what you've just said. So small frequency, so you feel like you might feel like you're just continually annoying your child, but always really frequently offering them fluids and a variety of fluid as well. You know, you might have something in a bottle, then you might have something else in a different cup or a cup with a straw, and then you might be offering some Hydrolyte icy poles, or it might be the Hydrolyte liquid, drink. You might need water that down a little bit because sometimes it is quite sweet, but any types of fluids, offering them small frequent amounts. And the best measure of a child's hydration is the amount of wet nappies that they're having. But this is also really challenging if they've got profuse diarrhea as well, to know if there's any wee in there as well. But yes, small sips of fluid, trying to keep an eye on their hydration, trying to, you know, have a bit of a diary or writing down roughly how much fluid that they're having, how many vomits and how much diarrhea they're having, because that can be really useful as well in our assessment of how unwell or how dehydrated a child may be.
Okay, and you already touched on urine output, but how much are we looking for in what period of time?
So with any child that was unwell with a virus, we would expect and we would like the child to be having at least 50% of their wet nappies. So if it was a baby with a cold, we would say that you need to present back to hospital or a GP if a baby was wet nappies were less than half of their usual heaviness. And so with a child that was having, that had gastro because they've got such profuse losses potentially, we want to ensure that they're having a couple of wet nappies a day. Okay. There's not an exact amount because it depends on the age of the child, so it's sort of tricky to answer that. But also, you know, whenever your child's unwell, whether that be gastro or whatever type of virus it is, making sure that, you know, you're following your gut instinct and, yeah, acting on that, because that's often, you know, the most accurate thing to do.
Yeah, and what's some other signs and symptoms of dehydration in children besides the wet nappies?
So often their behaviour, so some children that are really dehydrated, they may be really flat, really lethargic, and there's often this really vicious cycle of kids that have dehydration, that they're really flat and lethargic and tired, and then they don't want to drink and it's making them worse. So if you can try and beat that rapid cycle and try to offer the child fluid, that can be really helpful, even though they don't want it and they're probably fighting you. But other signs that a child is dehydrated, if you look at their skin colour, they might look a little bit more pale than usual. If it was a smaller baby, they may look a little bit more mottled, so their skin may look a little bit more veiny. If it's a baby, you might notice that they have a slightly sunken fontanelle. And with babies and young children, the number one thing is the easiest thing to keep an eye on is their wet nappies.
Okay. And I suppose they'd have dry lips too, might be one.
Yeah, often dry lips. Yep, you might see that their eyes might be a bit sunken, their mouth might be a bit dry as well. But, yeah, dry lips is a good one, quite a visual type thing as well.
Okay, awesome. So I think that gives everyone a good insight into gastro, lovely gastro. Hopefully people haven't had to go through that as yet, but I think most parents experience gastro through the house a couple of times. It's just one of those things that's really hard to avoid. As though you wash your hands as much as you can or whatever, use hand sanitizers, it's still, if it's in the house, it's very hard to avoid.
Yes, and one last thing about gastro actually is that you probably remember over the last couple of years whenever we're going in and out of lockdowns, then childcare would start back again and, you know, kids would start socialising again, then there'd always be this huge outbreak of gastro. And I think one of the contributing factors is that one of the main viruses that causes gastro, like the most common virus that causes gastro, isn't killed by alcohol. Mm. So everyone that's sanitising their hands, it's not helpful for gastro. So making sure that you wash your hands with soap and running water when you're dealing with gastro is your best or one of your best levels of defense. So back to the old school, washing your hands is really helpful.
Yeah, that's great information actually. Okay, could we go into rashes? Because I get lots of messages from mums with rashes of all sorts and a lot of concerns with, you know, if they've got a fever associated with the rashes. So I thought it'd be great if we can maybe go into rashes, when to actually seek medical attention, when there could be issues with them.
Yes, absolutely. So rashes, there's lots and lots and lots of different reasons why a baby or child might have a rash. It may be because they have a viral infection, so that's most definitely the common cause for a child that has a rash. But there's other things that could cause rashes. It could be an allergic reaction, it could be eczema, it could be an intolerance or a sensitivity to something. It could be, you know, something in the environment like grass or, you know, a woolen jumper, or it could be a heat rash or a teething rash or drooling rash or, I don't know, a rash because it's Wednesday. Some kids just have such sensitive skin. And others not as much. But the number one thing to do when a child has a rash is to push on it to check if the skin is blanching or not, to check if the rash is blanching. So what that means is if you get your finger and you push on your arm, and your skin should turn, should become more pale. So for me, my skin turns white and then comes back to my very palish pinky colour. So if the child had a rash that had red or purple spots and when you pushed on it, it didn't turn white, so it didn't blanch, that's called a non-blanching rash. So, for example, if you're listening to this, if you push somewhere in your body where you've got a freckle or a mole, when you push on your freckle, you'll notice that the freckle doesn't blanch. Mm-hmm. So if that was a rash, if that wasn't usually there, if that was a red or purple spot, and so it's non-blanching, then that's something that we are concerned about. And so you would need to present with your child to the nearest emergency department. There are a lot of things that can cause a non-blanching rash, these particular spots, but something that does cause these rashes is the meningococcal bacteria. So it's important that, a child is assessed very promptly and some investigations can be done to check if it was meningococcal. When a child has a rash, again, a rash is just one piece of the puzzle. So ensuring that the child, you're looking at the overall behaviour. Are they really sleepy or are they really irritable? Are they really difficult to settle? Are they, what's their neurological status like? Also, what's their breathing like? Is their breathing completely normal? Is it in the context of a fever or not? There's always these other indications and other things to be looking out for when a child has a rash. Like I said, most of the time it's caused by a virus. Almost everything's caused by a virus. They're so annoying, particularly when your child gets 6 to 12 of them a year. But always checking if a rash is blanching or not. There's a little saying that I like to tell people in the first aid courses, and that is if the rash – oh, I need to think about this now. If the rash, if you push on a rash and it turns white, then it's generally all right. Just a little rhyme to remember.
I love it. That's great. There's also a nurse, if people are in Australia listening to this, there's also a hotline that people can ring and get some nurses on the phone and advise them on whether they need to go to the emergency department or not, isn't there? Could you maybe just tell us about that?
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
Yes. So we're very lucky here in Australia. There's a few resources and a few different people that you can call. So if you're calling in regards to your baby, you can call the National Maternal Child Health Nurse line. It's a 24-hour line that they can help you with. And Nurse on Call is a fabulous resource that you can call for a patient or a person of any age, and they will be able to help sort of triage you and advise you if they think you need to go to emergency or not, or if you they believe it's safe to stay at home, they may give you a bit of a plan. And they'll also help you, you might call up because your child has a rash, and they'll prompt you through other things, asking you questions to help assess your child's as well, which is really helpful. And then the other options, there's also a number 136. So that's a number that you can call, and you can actually get in some places within Australia, you can get a doctor into your home at Bulk Build. So that's a fabulous resource. Then there's other virtual, some emergency departments have a virtual ED as well. So you can see a doctor plus at home via telehealth and other telehealth services as well. So there are a lot of different options available other than just presenting face-to-face to an emergency department. There's a lot of hesitancy within people presenting to an emergency department because they are concerned that they don't want to clog up the system, or they're concerned that there might be really long wait times. Mm. And it's important to remember that when you do present to an emergency department, that you treat as soon as you get there, you triage by a senior nurse, and that senior nurse will be assessing, looking out for these red flags, and will assess your child. And if your child's really unwell, they'll go through straight away. Mm. And if your child's deemed safe to wait, then they'll head to the waiting room. So please don't ever hesitate to go to an emergency department if you're really concerned about something and your parental instinct is telling you that something's not right. Don't not go to an emergency department because you might have to wait a long time.
Mm. No, that's great.
That's why the triage system's in place to prioritise this. Yeah.
That's great about the virtual doctors in the ED now. I wasn't aware of that. That's really good to hear.
Yeah, so it's just only in some areas.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But, yeah, there's a virtual emergency department now, which is amazing. And I know that there's some other hospitals that are looking at rolling it out as well to help, which, is fabulous. Sometimes if it is a baby or child, you need more than a virtual. You need a face-to-face because you need someone to look in their ears, look in their throat, listen to their chest. But if it's not that and they don't need a physical assessment, then these virtual options and nurse on call and these other resources are fabulous.
Absolutely. And even just having someone on the phone to reassure you if you're doing the right thing at home can be really valuable. I've rung them before. I've rung them multiple times.
Absolutely. Yeah, they're a fabulous resource.
There's nothing else you can think about. You know, you go into panic mode and your only concern is your child. So, you know, getting someone on the phone, and they'll advise you if you need to go to the ED too, which is great. So we've got lots of resources here. Okay,
yeah,
well,
they're really good.
Anything else on rashes? Because I did kind of segue away from that with the call options and the ED. Was there anything on rashes you wanted to touch on?
I don't think so. I think the important points to remember about rashes is that taking consideration the bigger picture, so looking at, the child's behaviour, their appearance, and checking if the rash is blanching or not.
Okay, awesome. Great information. I feel like I've asked you the main things that present. Have I missed anything? Is there a condition? I mean, there's choking and there's head injuries and stuff like that, but I feel like, I mean, choking is, oh wait, maybe it's not an obvious one. Did you want to touch on them at all? Is there another, you know, acute condition I've missed that's important to touch on?
Yeah, so we don't actually see a lot of kids in the emergency department that have choked or are choking, because such an acute thing.
Yeah, and that's right.
You've dislodged the object, it does, you know, you provide choking first aid appropriately, the object does dislodge very quickly majority of the time. It's incredibly rare that a child was to be choked on something and that item couldn't be quickly dislodged. So it's important that you know how to deliver appropriate choking first aid for a baby or a child. If a child was choking, so they've got a complete airway obstruction, so they'll be completely silent, they'll turn blue really quickly, their eyes will be bulging wide open, they might be clutching at their throat, staring at you in fear, like their eyes like, help me, help me, then you need to administer 5 back blows. But because a child's not breathing, you need to call an ambulance. So you always need to have an ambulance on the way if your child is choking. Mm. If you manage to dislodge the object and you feel comfortable to manage at home, you can absolutely cancel the ambulance if required. And calling an ambulance and cancelling an ambulance, the number one reason to do that is kids choking. But making sure that you know how to deliver choking first aid, so you know how to deliver those back blows to dislodge the object, because no one else can help. Like, you know, no one virtually can assist with that, or paramedics can't assist when they're 20 minutes away. It's on you. So it's an important skill that you're comfortable in responding to a choking child. So yes, because we don't really see much of that in emergency, that's very much a more community first aid type thing. Lots and lots of illnesses this time of year, so we've been chatting about. So lots of viral illnesses, respiratory illnesses, gastros, fevers, coughs, asthma group, bronchiolitis.
So we've covered most of the main ones that you're seeing time and time again in the ED.
Yes, day in, day out. And I think it's really hard as well, because particularly when they are babies or young toddlers that have these respiratory illnesses, you do need to see someone face-to-face. And a lot of the time it may be really challenging to get a face-to-face appointment with someone. So parents might be stuck between a rock and a hard place, and they're concerned about the well-being or the respiratory distress in their child. So absolutely they need to go to an emergency department, and that's not their fault. And, you know, it's not a reason not to attend. So making sure you're always advocating for yourself, advocating for your child, and, backing that parental intuition that you have.
Great. And as you said, they'll triage you. If you need to get in, you'll get straight in. So they're pretty amazing.
And look, the triage nurse might say to you, you know, they would never turn anyone away, but they might say, you know, right now I'm reassured by ABC. Mm-hmm. There's currently an X hour wait. If you can get into another doctor, a local hospital or a GP, it's probably going to be quicker. And if you feel safe to do so. But otherwise, sometimes if your child is triaged as a lower priority, then you may have to wait, but at least you're being observed in a safe environment.
And it's a reassurance once again, so that's so important.
Absolutely. And as a parent, you're not expected to diagnose your child or to understand, you know, what's serious and what's not. You, as a parent, you know, the expectation is that you know how to recognise what's normal and what's not. And, you know, if you're out of your comfort zone, if you're not sure, then definitely reach out for that help. That's not part of your role to be a health professional and try and diagnose and fix them either. So don't put that pressure on yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Great information there. Okay, well, I feel like we've gotten heaps of information out of you with kind of acute what to do with when to call the doctor or the nurse, or when to present to the ED in terms of the acute stuff that children, or even not acute, because those viral coughs can linger, like you said. But can we maybe just hear a little bit about your little first aid kits that you've got with Rhythm First Aid, and what you're doing with the training? Is it online? Is it only available in Melbourne? Because I think first aid is something that all parents should do, and I think a lot of them don't get around to doing it because life is busy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, on one hand, you can't blame parents for not doing first aid because there's so many things to do and to learn. And, you know, every parent says, oh, I really need to do it if they haven't. And it's never too late. Sometimes I have parents coming that have multiple children that aren't babies anymore, and they attend, or some people will attend a first aid course with their first child as well. But I really believe that a lot of things, you know, if you're equipped with this knowledge and skills, if you know this stuff about fever, if you know that the fever is not dangerous, then when your child has a fever, you're not up all night panicking, thinking that one of these myths that your child's brain's going to fry or they're going to have a seizure. You know that information. So it's actually going to really alleviate your stress, and it's quite empowering for the parent to understand that, and just remembering that knowledge is power, and it helps, I really think it helps with the parents' clarity and mental health and stress levels of dealing with their unwell children as well, because our first aid courses are so much more than a first aid course, you know, what to do with bleeding or drowning or whatever it may be. We talk about fevers, we talk about febrile convulsions, we talk about allergies, all these other types of things that are really helpful with you navigating different illnesses as well as the injuries. And so our first aid course is currently only available face-to-face in Victoria. However, by the end of the year, we will have a couple of different online versions. So that's very much a work in progress at the moment. We also deliver nationally recognised first aid courses as well, so workplace first aid to a variety of schools and, every different type of workplace. And then our first aid kit. So we've got these delicious-looking bespoke timber first aid boxes, and they contain 123 different items in there. So there's a digital under-the-arm thermometer, there's a little baby ice pack, the Steri-Strips, the splinter removal probes, there's a little antiseptic spray, the saline that you can use to clear out if a baby had a snotty nose. There's literally everything that you may need that is in there. And there's a lot of items when you buy a generic first aid kit, for example, a burn gel or a burn cream, and they should never be used on babies and children. So everything that's in our first aid kit are great, you know, premium products that are safe to use on babies and kids. And so those first aid kits they are made from sustainable pine, and they also have a option to personalise them as well. All first aid kits are usually really ugly. So when we were designing these first aid kits, we're like, why do they have to be ugly? You use it so much. Mm. Why can't it be nice looking? So we thought we'd do something a bit different and, yeah, make it sustainable and make it beautiful.
So where can our listeners find these first aid kits and potentially follow you along for when the first aid goes online?
Yes, so on our website, rhythmfirstaid.com.au, and rhythm is a horrible word to spell. It's R-H-Y-T-H-M. And we also have an Instagram page as well, where I'm often posting different tips and hints and information on baby and child health as well as first aid. And, you know, there's videos on there of what croup sounds like, for example. So it's really helpful to help familiarise yourself with these different illnesses and to equip you to respond appropriately as well. So, yes, come follow us on Instagram, Facebook, or on our website, Rhythm First Aid.
Yeah, and definitely do, because those videos are very helpful. I've seen a lot of your content and I think it's golden information. So, once again, thanks so much for coming on, sharing this, and I hope it gives some ease to some parents that tune into it.
Yes, I hope so too. Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks for making it all the way through this amazing podcast episode. I now have two things I want to share with you. So the first thing is my Wild Bloom online children's health course. This is a collaboration of naturopathic and Chinese medicine made an easy as accessible form for parents, with podcasts, videos, tutorials, and so much information that it just takes all the confusion out of raising your children naturally. I talk about gut health and antibiotics repair when you need to use them. I've got the first year of life, postnatal care, heaps of information on dietary and nutritional advice. There's Chinese medicine, and there's a whole section that's just on common ailments so that when your child is sick, you can look up and try some natural tools first. So this is available now at hearthmedicine.com, and you can use the code BLOOM to receive $50 off that course. The second thing is the Shoni Shin tools. These are traditional Japanese acupuncture tools for children. So there's no needles required. They're little metal tools that you basically massage along the channels of your children to help support their immune system, their digestive system, and their nervous system. These are amazing to try and include, you know, 2 to 3 times a week after a bath, just to support overall health. They come with instructional videos and are super easy to use. Children love them. They are also available at my website, hearthmedicine.com. So check them out, guys, and I'd love feedback on this podcast if you enjoyed it. Have a beautiful day. Thank you. online. Simply go to sandyrosshealth.com.